I'm Ron Barr, and welcome to this special World Airways in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. Sports Byline is America's sports talk show and is heard on more than 200 U.S. radio stations, Sirius satellite radio, as well as worldwide on the Internet and the more than 500 stations of the American Forces radio network. Sports Byline has been called the Nightline of Sports for its insightful, human, sometimes humorous, and certainly always interesting interviews with the biggest names in sports. On this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, we'll talk baseball with Brooks Robinson, arguably the greatest third baseman ever to play the game. Ronald Smith will join us. Smith is Professor Emeritus of Sports History at Penn State University and the author of an interesting and controversial book, Pay for Play, A History of Big-Time College Athletic Reform. And Nonito Donaire, a boxing champion, and Victor Conti, a man who helped athletes cheat, will join us to talk about themselves, their accomplishments, and why they're working together. So sit back and enjoy this special in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA. First up is the man they call the human vacuum cleaner, Hall of Fame third baseman Brooks Robinson. Robinson played his entire 23-year career with the Baltimore Orioles. He set the standard at third base with 16 consecutive gold gloves, and 8 times he led the league in most games played. Interestingly, Robinson never played high school baseball and was discovered in a church league. I asked him if he thought it was possible for a player today to play 23 years with just one team.
No, I don't think you're going to see that happen again. It just with the salaries the way they are, it'd be very, very unusual. Even to see players playing for that long on any team, I think that that's the one area where you're going to see players hanging around a little less.
What was the reason that you were able to do it that long?
Well, one of the reasons that I had no choice. I was with the Orioles forever until they said, hey, Brooks, we don't need you anymore. We're going to trade you. And they didn't trade me, but they did say, hey, Brooks, we don't need you anymore.
How difficult did it become playing all those years to maintain that fielding average of 971?
Well, I never thought too much about it, to tell you the truth. That was something I always enjoyed, that part of the game. I could always catch the ball. I had no problem doing that. And I mean, I can still catch it today if it's hit to me, Ron. But I guess the big question with Brooks Robinson was whether he'd be able to hit major league pitching or not. But defensively, you know, you just I enjoyed it and worked at it, and it was a lot of fun.
When you played as many games as you did you have to have a rest from time to time? And I ask that as a prelude to the question, obviously, about Cal Ripken Jr. and him playing night in and night out, day in and day out.
Well, I did get a rest every now and then, but I don't, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, really. I've had a day off or 2 days off and come back and be just as bad. So that's not really the total answer.
Brooks, when we take a look at you as a third baseman, and I had a chance to watch you during your career, was just amazed at how easy you made it look. And then during the All-Star game, the old-timers game, I had Steve Garvey with me that night. And I said, Steve, how'd you do? He said, it was fine until I hit it down third base, and there was Brooksy to scoop it up. made a couple of double plays in that game.
Well, that's right. I couldn't get out of the way of Stevie's. I'd wanted to, I'll tell you, but it was hit hot, and I just have to have the glove in the right spot. But it's a lot of fun. I just I had my fingers crossed on most of those plays. As I said before, I can still catch the ball, but I don't move around too well now.
Is it an instinctive position? How does somebody develop the type of skills that you developed?
Well, I think it's a God-given talent more than anything else, and it is an instinctive position. It's a reflex position. I started out, I signed as a second baseman, and I played my first 50 games at second. And then Paul Richards, who was a major league manager for the Orioles, and George Staller, who was my minor league manager, decided, hey, this fella, I think in the long run, is going to be better off at third base. So that is really the best thing that ever happened to me, because I don't think I could have played second on a long-term basis in the majors.
Brooks, one of the things I also noticed about you during your career was, as instinctive as it was, a position at third base, it was also a mental position. Now, I say that because depending upon what the pitch was going to be to the batter and what the situation was, I used to watch you slide one direction. Maybe it would only be an inch or 2 inches, that you were really kind of ahead of the situation. How mental is that position?
Well, you know, not any more so than the other positions. At third base, you don't move around a lot. But, you know, once you get to know the players and know the hitters and know their tendencies and things, there is you do slide one way or the other. A lot depends on who's, you know, pitching. When you had guys like Cuellar and McNally, who are basically ground ball pitchers, a lot of off-speed pitches, you know you're going to get a lot of work. And So that's really the big thing, I think, is knowing who's pitching and knowing what's coming. And as a third baseman, really the only thing that I wanted to know is when an off-speed pitch, like a screwball from Cuellar, a curveball, or a Jim Palmer big slow curveball. And I was, my shortstops can help you out there, because as a third baseman, you can't see the signs, but Belanger or Aparicio would always let me know by word of mouth, like be alive or something. So I knew something off-speed was coming, and I think that helped me a great deal. And in one particular play in the World Series against Johnny Bench, where I caught a ball over the third baseline about 3 or 4 feet in foul territory, it was almost like I had a running start because I knew what was coming, and I was just kind of leaning that way, and sure enough, he hit it right there.
Of all the series that you ever played in, was the World Series in 1970 against the Cincinnati Reds, and of course you had a great series both with the glove and the bat, but that stop of the Reds' Lee May, have you ever played a series of games as well as you did during that whole course of series?
No, that was kind of a strange series. I tell people I played almost 23 years professionally and never had a chance to, as an infielder, you can play a week, 2 weeks, and never get a chance to do something spectacular. But in this particular World Series, I was in the right spot just about every day. And, you know, going into the series, I really thought that Belanger and I would get a lot of work down there because when you talk about guys like Johnny Bench and Lee May and Tony Perez, I mean, they've got one thing in mind, and that's to hit it as far as they can every time they step up there. And consequently, we did get a lot of work on that left side of the infield.
St. Yeah. Louis, Kevin, go ahead.
Well, once again, it is an honor to talk to you, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm 35, so I remember how great you are very easily. And I believe that we have here the greatest defensive shortstop of all time, Ozzie Smith.
Uh-huh.
And you have, in Baltimore, obviously, greatest all-around offensive defensive shortstop in Cal Ripken. I'd like to know your opinion on who was the great, other than yourself, was the greatest all-around offensive, defensive third baseman you've ever seen.
Well, I tell you, I've always said the greatest is whoever you want it to be, but I think that if you took offense and defense, you'd have to say Mike Smith would be the best that I've seen play the game offensively and defensively. An outstanding defensive third baseman, and when you hit 500 home runs, that's pretty impressive too. So that's really what makes the world of sports go around. You know, when I retired back in 1977, and then Mike Smith just retired a few years ago, I had all these phone calls, and they were saying, well, who's the best, Brooks, you or Mike Smith? Who's the best? And I kept saying, look, the best is whoever you want it to be. And the same guy called me about five times, so finally I said, okay, the greatest third baseman in the history of the game was Pye Trainer. I said, Eddie Matthews was third, George Kell was fourth, I was fifth, and Mike Smith was sixth. Well, he didn't know what to say about that. And I would just kind of give him a hard time. But I would certainly say Mike Smith, when you talk about offense, defense, is the greatest one I've ever played against.
Okay, Seattle. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Brooks.
I was going to say, when you talk about defense, I played with Louis Aparicio, I played with Mark Belanger, and all my years of the game, day in and day out, I've never seen anybody do it like those two guys. I have talked to other people who they think that Ozzie Smith might be a cut above those two as far as defense is concerned. I will tell you, though, that playing on AstroTurf makes you a little better. I mean, you almost feel invincible. I mean, AstroTurf is, you see players, you know, catching the ball and running and throwing. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Okay, Roger in Shawnee, Kansas.
Yeah, two quicks and Brooksy. You're the greatest third baseman ever played a game.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
I remember I was about 5 days late to spring training, 1968, and the pitchers were on the mound doing their little bunt drills. There's nobody on the field but the pitchers, the first baseman. First ball I seen is rolled down third baseline, and Pete Rickard stands on a mound and don't move and yells, Brooksy! And
I'll tell you what,
Cincinnati is still complaining that you were lucky in that World Series. And I kept telling them, guys, those are routine plays for Brooksy.
Do you know who this is, Brooks?
No, I'm sorry. Roger who?
Spider.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
Roger Nelson.
Didn't get the name.
Yeah.
Well, I told you to say all those nice things anyway.
Well, you were, Brooksy. I'll tell you what. You're a pitcher's dream. And besides being an outstanding third baseman, the greatest to ever live, I don't care how many home runs Smitty hit, you're one of the finest people that ever played the game.
Well, I appreciate that. That's awful nice coming from you, and it's nice to talk to you.
Well, I listen to the show every night, and I hurried home. I'm lucky I didn't get a ticket. I had to get in and call, man. I'll never forget that spring training, though, man.
Well,
I couldn't believe it.
Well, I appreciate that. Nice. I've lost track of you anyway.
Well, I still live in Kansas City.
All right.
And I got you're announcing for him, right?
That's right. I'm coming out there on that Friday, Saturday, Sunday we're in there, so look me up.
Yeah, where do you guys stay at?
I'm staying at the Marriott at the airport.
Okay. I'll give you a call.
You got it.
Thank you,
Roger.
Brooks, did you analyze your game and early in your career decide you were going to work on one aspect or another because you knew that would be the dominant aspect of your game?
No, not really. You mean defensively all around?
Right. I mean defensively because maybe you thought you could help the team a little bit more with the glove than maybe with the bat.
Well, I tell you, I was lucky to get signed. I signed right out of high school, and I signed with. I had a few teams that were after me, but no one really thought that much of Brooks Robinson. I mean, I had average speed at best, average arm, terrific fielder. I hit well in Legion ball, but the one thing you cannot tell if someone's going to be able to hit major league pitching, it's almost an impossibility to look at someone who's 17, 18 and say, hey, this guy's going to make it. And it was a long, hard road for me. I was up and down like a bouncing ball, and finally, I got the knack of it. I got a little stronger physically. I got a chance to play every day, and I think that was the key more than anything else. But the other thing, I think most pitchers really felt like that I was an off-speed hitter, breaking ball hitter, and more so than anything else. And I think that helped me probably as much as anything. I could, hit the fastball or fight it off, but I waited a little longer and was able to hit the breaking ball. And I guess that's the true test that separates the men from the boys as the curveballs when you get to the big leagues.
Okay, Alex, go ahead in Meadville, Pennsylvania.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Again, as the first man said, it's an honor to talk to you, Mr. Robinson.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to ask you a couple questions about your play in the All-Star Games.
Okay.
And I wanted to mention, in case people don't know this out of here, you won an All-Star MVP, and that was during a stretch when the National League was winning most of the games. Does that MVP mean much to you?
Well, it sure does. That was a big day for me out in St. Louis. I made some good plays, and I went 3-for-4 in a game we lost in 10 innings, and it was absolutely the hottest game that I had ever played in my life. I mean, it was 120 on the field and people passing out like, in the stands, and that's what I remember about it. And in fact, they had an airline strike at that particular time, and we went to Philadelphia, I think Frank Robinson and myself, to play an exhibition game against the Phillies the next day up there. But that was really special. I had a chance to be the MVP back in 64 in the game at Shea Stadium, and then Dick Raddatz threw a home run ball to Johnny Callison, a 3-run homer in the last inning, and we lost that game. But I did play in a lot of losing games. I played in 18 games, 2 or 3 years. They had 2 games, and that was early back in like 60, 61, 62. But I played in 15 losing games. I won 2, and we tied 1. So I was on the losing end for a lot of times.
And I wanted to touch on that. Of course, the National League's now feeling that with the American League winning all the games. And they talked this year to some of the players who were trying to win one for Bobby Cox. Now, did you feel that way going into certain games, too?
Well, no, I really thought that when I first started playing back in the 60s that the National League could put a better representative team on the field simply because the National League started sounding the black guys first. And you talk about players like Aaron and Mays and Banks and Frank Robinson and that group. They just had a better all-star team than the American League did. I mean, we had guys like Mickey Mantle, Ted Williams, but overall the National League had the edge. When it got to be in, late in the middle of 1967, 68, or 69, there's no reason in the world we shouldn't have won our own at that particular, our fair share of those games. And it becomes psychological more than anything else, I think. But if you take a look at all those scores, I mean, man, it was a slew of 2-1, 4-3, and, they had to come back and win in the ninth inning. And but early in my career, the National League just had a better all-star team.
Okay, Grand Island, New York. Scott, you're on with Brooks Robinson.
How you doing?
Good.
Fine, thank you. How you doing, Scott?
Pretty good.
First of
all, I just want to tell you that Baltimore's always been my favorite team, and you've always been my favorite player.
Thank you.
I was just wondering, during the 70s, a lot of people were comparing guys like Craig Nettles and Relly Rodriguez to you, and I was just wondering how that felt.
Well, those two guys you mentioned are just an outstanding third base. And I'll tell you the way I feel about that. You know, I think it's really who you watch. You know, if you watched Aurelio Rodriguez every game, 162 games, you've got to say to yourself, hey, this guy's the best. How can you be any better? Or if you watched a Craig Nettles or a Mike Schmidt, I mean, these are it's as good as you can get. I mean, they can do everything at third base. And so what I always tell people, it really comes down to who you watch more than anything else. And that's really the way I look at those things. I ended up winning the Gold Gloves and probably won a couple of them late in my career that I shouldn't have. I won it on just to be another little reputation, you know, but that's the way sports are, and a lot of times it works in your favor.
Okay, Scott, New Orleans, we got you with Brooks Robinson.
Brooks, I share something with about thousands of other people in the country. I have a son named Brooks, named after you. What is it about players nowadays that they can't seem to rise above pettiness and whatever else and become more legendary, especially in baseball as compared to other sports?
Well, I tell you, it's hard to say. I mean, there's a you take a club like the Orioles, and, you know, every one of these guys, I mean, there is a different atmosphere, a different attitude, I think, and a lot of it is brought on by the money that these guys make at this particular time. But all these guys in the major leagues, I mean, they never wanted to do anything in their whole life except be a professional baseball player and play in the big leagues. And they work very hard at it, whether you believe it or not. All of them have special charities that they give to, they work at. And a lot of these things don't get publicized. But I try to tell people that, you know, the game today, it's a production. I mean, if you have a fight tonight in Timbuktu, believe me, you tune into ESPN and you're going to see that fight seven different ways. Everything that the players do now is magnified. I mean, the press, the radio, the TV, and they're just under a microscope more maybe than we were. And I don't know how else I can really answer that, except there's a lot of good guys, but the money aspect has changed a lot of the attitudes of the players now, and that's just a fact of life, you know. So I don't know if I've confused you or answered your question.
Well, Scott, I also might add something to what Brooks says, is that I think the attitude and the approach of the media has changed a great deal as well. They tend to dwell maybe a little bit more on the negative. In other words, it makes the headlines a little bit more than the positive does. And while the attitudes have changed, the money is greater, and I think that the general population's perspective of athletes have changed because of the media, I think that there are still some good people out there, like Brooks was talking about, that give a lot of time, a lot of their money to worthwhile causes, and they're good role models. The trouble is that we hear so much negative about athletes, and I'm not saying that's necessarily wrong, that I think that sometimes persuades us to believe that that's the only thing that is evident about athletes today.
Well, I think so. I mean, the writers are certainly a little different. I think that even before my time, I mean, it was like the writers were part of the team, you know, and now you have competing newspapers, and maybe you had them then, too. I don't know, but, you know, that editor, he wants something besides a game story. He wants a little inside stuff. He wants to know what's going on, who's doing this, who's doing that. So it is a little different, and so that might help answer your question.
Okay, Kevin, quickly in Seattle.
Hi, Brooks. It's a real honor to talk to you. I think you're one of the greatest.
Thank you very much.
Okay, I have two questions. First of all, I'd like to know what's your most memorable defensive play, if you have one, and also what's the most memorable game that you've ever played in?
Well, I don't really have a most memorable play, I guess you could say, but certainly the play I made in the World Series off of Lee May, it gets a little more publicity than anything else I've ever done, because it was the World Series, and I still see flashbacks of it every now and then on television, and it was kind of an unusual play, because I don't think I ever made one like that in my career. Usually when you backhand the ball over the bag, you stop, you plant, you fire to first base and try to get him. This time I just got it, and I threw on the run, off balance, it took one bounce to Boog Powell, and Lee May was out. And just a little sidebar to that, every time I see Lee May, who he plays for, he coaches for Kansas City now, he'll look at me and the first thing he'll say to me is, "Hey, Robinson, no one would have ever heard of you if I hadn't hit that ball down to you in the World Series." So that gives me a little humility. As far as the most memorable game, I always say that, my first World Series in 66 was the highlight of my career. It was the first time around for everyone on that team except Frank Robinson, who played in the 61 World Series. So I always think that particular particular series was a highlight of my career. As far as a memorable game, I played a game, and this is just kind of off the top of my head, back in 64 when the Orioles and the White Sox and the Yankees were going head-to-head in the last couple weeks of the season. I came up top of the ninth in Comiskey Park off of Joe Harlan and hit a three-run homer to win the game. And that was always, I just feel like, a real clutch blow and something that really, at that particular time, I said, man, this is really something. So that's about the only time I can think about that.
It's safe to say Brooks Robinson was one of a kind. Moving on now to college athletics, there's an ongoing debate whether college athletes or student athletes should receive additional financial support and whether college sports overall is simply just big business and out of control. Ronald Smith has tried to answer those questions by writing Pay for Play, A History of Big-Time College Athletic Reform. In his book, Smith traces the history of current university athletic standards and attempts to analyze college sports reform. He also tackles important questions about eligibility, compensation, recruiting, corruption, and leveling the playing field. College sports reform is a difficult subject, so I asked Professor Smith how hard it was to write his book.
Well, I don't know how hard it was. Anytime you write, it's hard. Writing is hard work, but I started researching a long, long time ago in the 1960s when I was working on my PhD at the University of Wisconsin. So I've been at it for a long time, and it's hard work. And all the stuff I put in the back of the book basically was to indicate that I've read a lot of stuff, and what I've tried to put in there is accurate material.
I looked through the book, and it immediately became clear to me that if you read this book, unless you were an expert in it, it is very, very confusing because there are a lot of forces that are in play when it comes to college athletics and efforts to reform them. Am I correct in that observation?
You're absolutely correct, because it's never quite clear who is in control of college athletics, as you might guess. Is it the alumni? At one time, it was 100% students who were in control. Is it the faculty? No, they don't have much control over athletics. Is it the athletic directors and conference commissioners? Is it ESPN and the networks that control it? Is it the boards of trustees? Is it the presidents? The presidents think they do, but they don't really. So it's confusing as to who controls athletics.
And it's also interesting to see how it's changed over the years. And this book traces attempts at college athletic reform from 1855 through the early 21st century. Let's have a little bit of a history lesson on college athletics and its process over those years.
Well, first of all, college athletics started completely by student control. And the first sport happened to be rowing. The reason it was rowing is because Oxford and Cambridge in England started out with rowing and cricket. We started out with rowing and baseball. And from that point, with students running it, there were lots of problems. One, they were running into debt eventually, and it was embarrassing the schools. So presidents and boards of trustees came in, and faculty didn't like the fact that students were staying away from school to play sports and traveling hundreds of miles to go to various sports. And so a whole lot of different people came in to control intercollegiate athletics. And so there has been a change. Today, you look at the National Collegiate Athletic Association, it's completely run by presidents, although I must admit conference commissioners have a great deal of say on what goes on in intercollegiate athletics.
When you take a look at that span of time up to today, what are the significant signposts along the way that have affected college athletics, Ronald?
Well, a lot of people would say that it has moved from an amateur spirit to a commercial professional one. I don't quite look at it that way. I think it's been commercial since the very first contest. The very first contest was 1852, a crew contest between Harvard and Yale. And who sponsored it? A railroad. And where was it? At a vacation spot in New Hampshire, Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire. And so it's been commercial from the very first. And by the 1860s, we hired our first professional coach. So it was professionalized at a very early time. Yale wanted to beat Harvard and crew, and so hired a professional coach. And, of course, as you know now, we're paying coaches $4 and $5 million a year, and it's going to go up. And it doesn't look like there's going to be any real stopping of that.
You know as well as I do, because of the academic nature of colleges, that they always prefer to refer to the athlete as student athletes. Is that a misnomer?
Well, you can read 200 and some pages of this pay for play, a history of big time college athletic reform, and I have never used the term student athlete. I think it was created to make it look this was done in the 1950s by Walter Byers, the first executive secretary of the NCAA, and he did it in order to create the image that athletes were students. And while many of them are, it was done for political purposes. And one political purpose was so that they wouldn't be taxed as a professional commercial entity, which might be taxable, like the pro leagues. The NFL is taxable. College athletics is not taxable. And so they did it to make it look like athletes were students first. They aren't necessarily students first.
Ronald, it appears to me, and somebody that's been in sports for a long time, if I look over the landscape of college athletics, a couple of significant events probably played into the growth of college athletics. One would probably be the scholarships that are given athletes to play the sport at the universities and the colleges. The other would be, of course, the injection of television. Is there anything else, and would you address those two as far as the importance in the growth of college athletics?
Well, both of them are very interesting things. Scholarships were absolutely anathema. People hated people that wanted athletics to be part of the educational system, absolutely hated, quote, athletic scholarships. Paying a player to go to school so that he could participate in sports. On the other hand, schools, especially in the Southeastern Conference, started giving out athletic scholarships in the 1930s. Previous to that, they were giving them under the table. Ivy League schools were doing that. The Big Ten was doing that. SEC was doing that. And they started, Southeast Conference started giving out scholarships in the 1930s, and this unleveled the playing field. Therefore, they were recruiting in the North, paying them to come down to the South to play, and especially the Big Ten was upset that they were losing players to Southern schools. So they had to do things. First, they did it under the table, and secondly, by the 1950s, the Big Ten started giving out athletic scholarships to level the playing field so that they could get their fair share of really good athletes. The TV thing, even though most people don't know that the first televised college sport was in the 1930s, 1939, it wasn't until after World War II that it really became important. And by the 1950s, it was very important. And so the NCAA took over control of especially college football. And that was when the time when there was one game of the week. And it was a monopoly, and eventually it was broken up in the 1980s by the Supreme Court. So television, athletic scholarships, extremely important. Television has commercialized intercollegiate sports to the umpth degree, and that's why we have very large salaries for coaches in the two sports that make money, men's basketball and football. Interestingly, women's basketball, which is the most important women's sport, loses money in every campus except maybe a couple.
Are there any other things along the way besides the scholarships and also television that has been important in the development of college athletics in your mind?
Oh, I think the rivalry between schools. It's interesting that in America, we do not have, historically anyway, we do not have very much federal government control over what colleges were formed and how much money they would get, unlike European institutions and those in the British Isles where the government has supported those schools. Our schools in America are basically independent. They're always trying to, one, be survival institutions, and secondly, once they've survived, they want to be at the top of the heap. Football and basketball, and especially football, has advertised the institution free, and that's one of the reasons why presidents and governing boards and alumni and hanger-oners love college sport. They want the free advertising that comes to develop that institution. I happen to be at Penn State, and we would never think of doing away with big-time football because it brings such great advertising to the institution. Now, some of the reformers don't think it's good advertising, but almost everybody within the institution that's in an administrative position thinks it advertises the institution, and it's free advertising.
Ronald A. Smith is with us on Sports Byline. Again, I urge you to check out his book. It's called Pay for Play, A History of Big-Time College Athletic Reform. I mentioned about the NCAA. You touched on it briefly. Tell everybody how it came about and what it actually does.
Well, the creation of the National Collegiate Athletic Association came completely because of one football season, and that was the football season in the fall of 1905. When there were a number of injuries and a whole lot of questions about the morality of football. And it arose when a football player from Union College was killed or died in a tackle and with a hemorrhage. And one thinks of today the problems that we're having with helmets and the number of injuries there and the trauma to the head. But in 1905, it was that accident in a game, a relatively unimportant game between New York University and Union College, when this back made a tackle and died after it. And they asked the most important president of any university in America, probably in American history, Charles Eliot at Harvard University, if he would take charge of a reform movement to see if they could make this a less dangerous game. And Eliot refused, saying presidents can't reform intercollegiate athletics. And I happen to agree with that. They couldn't then and they can't now. But he declined heading up a reform movement, so the New York University president said, I will do it. He set up a small group to see if they should reform or ban football. This group decided to reform it. And he then asked every university that had college football to meet in New York City. And at the end of December 1905, the NCAA doesn't quite have this right. They think it started in 1906. But at the end of December 1905, these schools met and created what became the National Collegiate Athletic Association. And it was only for the first almost 50 years of it a debating society. They passed no reform rules, nothing, except they did reform football rules at first and then took on all the rest of the rules of how do you play a basketball game, how do you play a lacrosse game, how do you run track for the first 50 years. And then right after World War II, they just said, we better do something about scholarships and recruiting. And then that was the first passage of anything by the National Collegiate Athletic Association. And at the same time, very close there, they said, we have to control television because television could ruin football because people would stay home to watch the game rather than coming to the contest. And so those are the first two things, passage of eligibility rules, in recruiting and control of television. Since then, NCAA has many, many controls on the number of coaches they can have, for instance, and a whole range of rules that have come through, including eligibility rules.
When I take a look at college athletics today and the effort and what we're talking here about athletic reform, it appears to me that the NCAA today is ill-prepared to be able to deal with any type of reform at all. And I say that because if I'm not mistaken, the NCAA is made up of the member schools, the presidents, and the chancellors. And aren't we talking about academic people that really don't know about the real world of big-time money and big-time money in athletics?
Well, Ron, I might argue a little bit there with you. It's The NCAA, in fact, may not be able to reform intercollegiate athletics, in part because individual presidents who run the NCAA basically are cheerleaders for their own institution, not reformers. And so they want to reform everybody else, but they don't want to reform their own institution. And so they have all of these good sayings that we would like to do this, we would like to do that, we would like to raise eligibility standards. But in fact, they don't want to do it at their own institution, and they have something which I call presidential admits into the university. Every major university in America, including Stanford out in your area, Penn State here, Alabama, Auburn, all of them allow presidential admits, people that couldn't ordinarily get into their institution, but they need them for especially basketball and football. And so at Stanford, for instance, there might be a 300-point difference between the average student body and the average SAT score of their football and basketball players. And that's true whether it's Notre Dame or Stanford or Penn State. There's a huge difference. So you ask the question, can the NCAA reform intercollegiate athletics? Maybe, maybe not. But if it gets really bad, where you're going to find the reform of intercollegiate athletics is either by the federal legislature, Congress, or by the courts. And the courts, as you may know, reformed intercollegiate sports for women by the passage of Title IX in 1972. And legislation has come on various things, including civil rights and allowing blacks to come into sports as well as other blacks coming into other areas of higher education. So courts and the legislature may be the best place for reform if the presidents and the NCAA choose not to do it.
By the way, I agree with you with your analysis of the fact that they want to see reform, but they don't want to do it at their own school. But I also think, and if I'm wrong, correct me on this, that I think that they're in conflict, because while these presidents, and I've said this on the air, and it may not be fair, I said they don't know if the ball's stuffed or blown up, while they talk about reform and doing these sort of things, they also want to be able to get money from their alums, not only for their athletic programs, but for the university overall. And if somebody tried to reform college athletics or even their own school, and the school went from being a team that won 10 or 11 games and went to a bowl and had a shot at the national championship, but because they did and didn't get the same caliber of athlete, that all of a sudden they dropped down to being a 6-6 team, no university president would do that. The other thing is that I found that these university presidents love flying on the people who give them the money, their corporate jets going off and watching their football team play somewhere around the country.
I think you have it absolutely correct, Ron. That is a major problem. The presidents are caught in between commercialism, which they need to run the program and to satisfy those alumni and other people in their community, for instance, states or at Notre Dame, maybe the Catholic religion. They're caught in between the commercialism and then having athletes be really students. And I think you have it right.
Are the presidents, and I don't want to come down too hard on them, but I don't think they're equipped, as I said, to deal in the commercial world of big-time college athletics. I mean, are they not pimping out their sports if they allow, say, their football game to be moved to 11 o'clock in the morning because it's going to be televised by ESPN or any of the other broadcast networks? I mean, if you give in on things like that because it's money that's coming in, I don't see where you can have any moral backbone to be able to make the tough decisions.
And I think you have it right there. ESPN was terrific for the commercialization of college and other sports. But ESPN has and would do it every minute of the day, all days of the week, if they could. And they are moving in that direction so that there are basketball games televised every night of the week, many afternoons during the week. And they would love to move football games to all days of the week and are essentially doing that, especially of the second rank of the big-time schools.
Professor Ronald Smith, and you can be sure the controversy and discussion on reforming college athletics will continue. Finally, we spend time with a boxing champion and also a man who helped athletes cheat. The boxing champion, Nonito Donaire, and the man who helped athletes cheat is Victor Conti. Donaire is a clean athlete who is a Filipino-American boxer who holds the WBC and WBO Bantamweight World Championship and has won 5 world titles in 3 different boxing weight classes. He went to the same school in the Philippines as champion Manny Pacquiao. Victor Conti did jail time for his role in the Balco performance-enhancing drug scandal that involved athletes in football, baseball, track, and field. Some of the biggest names in sports used his illegal products. He now wants to clean up sports and be a crusader for fair and clean competition. He's back in sports helping Donaire in boxing and Marlon Byrd of the Cubs in baseball. Recently, he and Donaire were the focus of an HBO Real Sports piece. So I started by asking Conti what was his motivation and reason for doing the HBO piece.
Well, originally, a piece was done by the Los Angeles Times in December of 2009 after I'd been working with Andre Ward, and he won the championship against Kessler. And I guess HBO saw that and reached out to me shortly thereafter. And it took about a year for the whole thing to develop. I went to New York and met with one of the producers back there. And then once they learned about me working with Marlon Byrd, the Major League Baseball All-Star, as well as Nonito Donaire, they reached out and asked if they could send a film crew and follow us around for a day and do some one-on-one interviews with myself and Marlon and Nonito, and that's exactly what occurred.
One of the things I always ask athletes, and I think it's appropriate to talk to you about this, is have you had a chance to kind of sit back and reflect on what you went through, what you did, and where you want to go from here?
Absolutely. That started from the very beginning, right after the infamous Balco raid in September of 2003. And, I obviously knew that what I had done was wrong. It was all wrong, and many people were damaged and harmed by these very poor decisions that I made to take that trip down the slippery slope and join the culture of using performance-enhancing drugs. And so I feel very blessed and fortunate and glad that there are people like Nonito in the world that can find forgiveness in their hearts and allow me an opportunity to work with elite athletes again.
Yeah, I was interested because, I've talked to you a number of times, and I've always found you very honest, very open about things, and yet I'm wondering whether you ever understood why you decided to go the direction you went before you got to this particular point. And I think I understand why, and if I'm wrong about this, correct me. I remember in our interview right after everything came down, you said to me that you always had the driving force to see an athlete get the most out of themselves. And I don't think that you necessarily thought what you were doing was wrong. You knew it probably was breaking the rules of the game, but that you were kind of almost testing, in a sense, to find out how good an athlete could be. Am I correct in that observation?
The challenge was a part of it, no question. I think what really made me finally make the decision to join the culture, and a lot of people don't understand that I started working with world-class athletes in 1984, and I'd work with Super Bowl teams, the Denver Broncos, when they won back-to-back Super Bowls in 97, 98. I'd worked with Alberto Salazar, who was a world record holder in the 80s in the marathon, Matt Biondi, who was the world's fastest swimmer in the 80s. And I learned in 1992, in fact, it was with a guy that my first interview with you 23 years ago here, Greg Trefalis, actually at the National Championships, Track and Field Championships in New Orleans in 1992, he tested positive for Dianabol. And I had heard from an Olympic official that I'd become fairly close with that there were some positive drug tests in 1988 at the Olympic Games. But after this positive test at the Track and Field Championships in 1992, and this gentleman called me and told me that, your boy tested positive, meaning Greg, and of course I talked to him about it, I didn't have anything to do with giving any of these athletes performance-enhancing drugs until 2000, so this was 8 years before that. But later, he called back 4 or 5 days later, and he said, listen, you can tell your boy that he's off the hook. A group of the elder statesmen have decided that they're going to cover up these positive drug tests and sweep them under the rug. Once I had that knowledge directly from an Olympic official that this is what happens at the highest level of sport, that those who control the majority of the financial gain are the ones that make these sorts of decisions. It was a number of years before I actually was introduced to Patrick Arnold, who had the original CLEAR, as I named it, but it was something that he'd gotten out of the Merck Index called Norbolethone, and it was undetectable, and I knew it was undetectable, and I made that decision to join the culture. It was a very bad decision, but the logic that I used, or rationale that I used, was that I'd become very close with these athletes. I knew their wives, I knew their kids, and I knew that they had life after sport, and because I owned a fully licensed clinical laboratory, we could do the testing on cholesterol fractions and liver function and kidney function. And my rationale was that I could help them do what they were already doing, but in a more safe and effective manner. And it was a bad decision. It was just, I'm just trying to lead you through, you know, my thinking process, and it was certainly wrong. And if I could do it all over again, I would have never made that decision.
I certainly know that frustration is a motivating factor in everybody's life to some degree. And I'm just wondering whether the frustration has been transferred, because after all of this came down, I remember you sitting here in the studio and telling me that you wanted to help kind of clean up sports and everything. And you have tried. There has been no doubt. And I saw in the HBO Real piece where you've just been pushed aside, where somebody with the experience that you have, they've not taken advantage of it. Why do you think that is?
That's a very good question, and you're right. I've reached out and met with both USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, as well as WADA. And in fact, I've been working on a recent project with them involving a designer substance. And at a certain point, I told Dick Pound, who was the founder and chairman of WADA, that he should go back and take a look at the notes. I flew to New York at their expense December the 12th of 2007, and I sat down with Dick in a conference room together with another lawyer who was the scriber, and they scribed 3.5 hours of our discussion. Long story short, when I asked him to go back and look at those notes to verify that what I told him 3 or 4 years ago, I was now, in essence, proving that what I was saying was true, he got back to me and said, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you, but the notes from your meeting have been destroyed." So my deduction is they really don't want to know what's going on.
When people hear the name Victor Conti, what do you think their impression is today?
I'm hoping that it's changing, that that now I can try to do what Nonito and other athletes do by inspiring other people, that, you know, that I do have the heart of a good person, and just because I've made all these mistakes caused so much suffering and pain to so many people, that doesn't mean I have to give up, that I can continue to try to make a contribution and help other people.
Have you had an awakening about being able to work with Nonito and Marlon Byrd and seeing how they are able to perform, doing it the right way, the honest way? I mean, did the light come on and say to Victor Conti, why in the hell didn't I do this before this way?
Yes, most certainly. And really, that's something that I'm very, very, you know, grateful to Nonito and Marlon. And I can tell you here today that Nonito is as clean of an athlete, and he's just a great person in addition to being a great athlete. There's lots of very good athletes out there, but Nonito's also a terrific human being. And it takes a special person like him to be able to forgive someone and actually take on that cost or that burden of being associated with somebody like me.
How bad is cheating with the performance-enhancing substances today in your mind?
I think that it is less than it was pre-Balco raid in 2003. And at the elite level then, it may have been 80%, would be a rough guess on my part. And it may be down to 50, 60% now, but I still believe it's a majority.
Across the board in all sports?
Across the board in all sports. It's worse in some sports than others. As an example, Tour de France riders, I still believe that it's 100%. But in other sports, it's less. And the testing has been effective. But that's the great part of this entire story that I think was being told on HBO Real Sports. Nonito is 100% clean. He does everything the right way. And he is a multiple-time world champion. And as he said recently, I believe this is only the beginning for Nonito.
And I don't believe that it'll ever get under control. I think the genie is out of the bottle here. Athletes are always going to do whatever it takes because the rewards of being victorious probably overwhelm the thoughts of defeat.
And you know, living with that, you know, knowing that you didn't do it the right way. I think that you the athlete cheats themselves out of that satisfaction, how sweet it is to know that you've done it the right way. I think that's something that an athlete like Nonito and Marlon have, that others that known that they've been down that slippery slope and they've got, there's a deep, dark secret there. I think it makes it much more gratifying to someone that's put in all that hard work.
Nonito Donaire is with us in the studio, Filipino-American professional boxer, and I tell you what, watching this young man in the ring, just the way he moves, you can almost tell, you know, people that are special in a particular sport. I know over the years that I've been doing play-by-play, there were people like John Elway, and there were people, other people in other sports that I saw that you just knew that they were going to be something special, and this young man is very, very special. You know, I mentioned to you that, you know, you went to the same school in the Philippines as Manny Pacquiao. That, to me, what was it like growing up having gone to that same school? What did they talk about Manny Pacquiao?
Well, really nothing. I mean, at that time, Manny was really poor. I mean, I didn't know who he was, actually, mm-hmm. until I met him in the United States. But, you know, to be in the same school my mom was teaching at and Manny went, I mean, it's crazy.
He is something certainly of a legend, not only in the Philippines, but around the world. What is it that makes him a great champion in your mind?
Well, not only that, he shows the humility and you know, the poverty, what he went through, that people, it's kind of like from rag to riches kind of thing, you know. But not only that, he explodes in that ring. He has defeated numerous champions, and he has proven himself to be the best. And you know, that's really what people can really capture. But aside from that, from Filipinos, they can relate to how he has grown and how he has become now, you know, a very well-respected person.
I think that there is a difference in the definition of a boxer slash fighter and a champion. I want to know what your perception and your definition of the word boxing champion is.
Well, boxing champion is proving yourself, fighting the best out there, you know, and just going through it without anything. I mean, just being who you are and defeating the guys that you know, that believe that supposedly are better than you, and you prove everybody wrong that, you know, you can defeat anybody as long as you put your mind into it. And that's what he is a boxing world champion.
And you are too as well. And I've always been interested in the mindset that makes somebody be able to go into the ring and do something very brutal, and then when they come out, be as nice as you are. You got to be able to throw that switch on. I think, you know,
it's so weird, because this last fight, I mean, Fernando Montiel is a friend of mine, and as we went through the press conference, you know, we hug each other and we say each other, you know, good luck, and then, you know, you're a friend of mine, but this is just business. But once actually on the day of the weigh-ins, that's when everything just started switching, you know, as we went face off, you know, after the weigh-ins, I guess from being deprived of food and liquids and, you know, dehydrated. And when we look at each other, we know what we want to do in that ring, and that is to destroy each other, or, you know, get the best of each other. And inside that ring, the switch just turns on fully, and you're ready to go.
That mind game in which you have to go from being an average person to being somebody angry, and angry is what you've got to be in the ring in order to do what you have to do. None of us probably could understand it. Give me some insight, Nonito, and what you do. What do you have to do with your mind to allow yourself to take care of business in the ring?
I don't see it as anger, actually. I see it as, I look at boxing as art. You know, whatever I put a game plan outside of that ring, I want to accomplish it and achieve it inside that ring. And that is very satisfying for me. But it's more of competitiveness. It's not anger. It's like playing basketball. You know, you want to run the best. You want to shoot right. You want to steal the ball. And you just give it all you got, you know. And it's kind of that feeling for me. I go in that ring and I want to hit him. I want to make him miss. I want to make him, I want to trap him with my style and take advantage of it. And that's how you really look at it. The only time I was really angry was the Derchinian fight. And you know, I wanted to get up. I wanted him to get up more and just keep dropping him. You know, that was pretty much the only time I was really angry, where I didn't care about the championship, where I didn't care about anything but just hitting this guy. But usually the majority of my fights, especially with the Fernando Montiel, I look at it as art. And as putting it as a game plan and achieving it in that sense. But there's really no hatred or anger in my part.
Well, I'm going to make an observation, and if I'm wrong about this, correct me, please. And that is in watching you, and I've watched you in two fights, and I thought to myself, this is a young man, this is a champion that likes breaking down the art of boxing, that you love to take a look and say, he's doing this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to prepare for the fight in this way. You like the mental stimulation as much as you do the physical stimulation.
That is what that's what satisfies me more, because, I mean, I plan on knocking everybody out, but if I don't accomplish that, that means I made a flaw in looking at my opponent, in analyzing the opponent's steps, punches, and position in body. And I'd look at that, like this last fight with Fernando Montiel, I looked at it where he's going to be, where his head is going to be, how he protects himself, where his defense is going to be, how he's going to attack, or what's the first reaction when I scare him away, when I faint him, what's his first reaction? And that was a hook, you know, or his left side was mostly the dominant side on him. So, you know, I just pretty much break it down and see what I can be comfortable in taking a punch or in avoiding a punch or creating a situation where a fight can be over within a single punch.
You're a young fighter still developing, and I'm wondering if you're aware of the fact that you might get pulled into a trap. I heard you say you expect to knock everybody out. And, of course, that's a little bit like coming to the plate and saying, I'm going to hit a home run every time. And I remember Tony Gwynn, the Hall of Fame baseball player, said to me, he said, the mistake that most good hitters make is that they want to pull the ball. But if the ball's on the outside part of the plate, you just go with the ball and go the opposite way. Do you look at fights? Are you mature enough now in your fight capabilities, Nonito, to be able to say, wait a minute, maybe I can't knock this guy out, but I'm going to do whatever it takes to be able to win, if you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, with Montiel, I expected a chess match game, but if it went 12 rounds, 20 rounds, 50 rounds, I'm always willing. That's why I train hard with Victor and with Remy, you know, and all my guys, Michael Basil, my strength trainer, my ART guys, and my trainers, Jonathan and Robert Garcia, you know, we train really hard, like we're fighting for a full 12 rounds, but, you know, we just have the game plan to try to knock everybody out. And if it doesn't happen, we are, you know, educated enough or experienced enough to see how we can be victorious at the end of it all.
I want to ask you, in that Real Sports show that you were on and also Victor was on, they had a piece also on Mike Tyson as well. And one thing that was always said of Mike, among many things said about Mike Tyson, was that he was somebody that appreciated the history of boxing, that he understood the great champions and what they did. I'm going to ask you, you know, are you a historian? Do you appreciate kind of the history of the sport as well as some of the people that have been champions? I mean, have you studied up on them? Do you have your favorites along the way?
I'm an old school fighter. That's who I am. You know, the way I fight, the way I think, and the way I give myself in that ring, you know, I learned from the art of the old school fighting, from Sugar Robinson, you know, from Muhammad Ali, and of course the guys, Sugar Leonard, Hagler, Hearns, Duran, all those guys, Salvador Sanchez, you know, Wilfredo Gomez. I mean, those guys, you know, Aguero. I mean, you name it. You know, I enjoy those fights. Those fights were incredible, and those are the guys that I've learned from growing up. I mean, as well as, you know, from Trinidad De La Hoya and all those guys, Roy Jones, I've learned, but from the beginning, it was from the old school fights, and I still have that mentality of respecting and acknowledging the old school fights.
I anticipated your answer, and so you kind of set me up with the next question, Nonito, and that is the fact, what is the commonality that the great fighters, the truly great fighters that you mentioned, what do they all do well?
They fought each other. You know, these days, a lot of the guys tend to not fight each other, or guys who they feel like they could take advantage. Back then, they didn't care who it is. If the guy was on top, they'll fight the guys on top. You know, it was only one person who dominated it, or if another, then they were going to see who's better, you know. But the old school is just the heart. They have the heart of a champion. You know, they're willing and they're not afraid, you know. As much as they feel like the guy's going to be tough, you know, that doesn't scare them. Just the thought of being there and just being with the best guys and proving yourself better and just giving it all. I mean, there's so many fights out there that you can tell. Like Arguello and Pryor, I mean, they were going at it. Arguello was getting hit like crazy. Or Salvador Sanchez and Wilfredo Gomez, when he broke his cheekbones and, you know, he was really beaten up and he still kept going. I mean, that's the heart of a champion. I mean, you'll see it sometimes around here with the Mexican fighters and other guys, but it's not too often as it was back then.
Nonito Donaire showing the skill and talent can make you a winner and champion, and Victor Cani admitting the error of his ways and wanting to help make sure all athletes compete on an even playing field. I hope you've enjoyed World Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcasts on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius Satellite Radio Channel 122, and the Internet. If you'd like a listing of Sports Byline's radio affiliates, be sure to check out our award-winning website at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.